Continue with this until you find it as easy to wander around the room in your imagination as you do in your physical body. You may notice that in this exercise you consistently forget some object in the room. Should this occur, it is often useful to try a little self-analysis. Why should it be that one object which gives you trouble and not another? What are your feelings towards it generally, and why do you have these feelings? You may find the reason for your lapses of memory is some unpleasant association with the object which you had consciously forgotten. Your next exercise is very similar to the last. Again, it involves the imaginary examination of a room. But this time choose one in some other part of the house. Treat it exactly as you treated the room in which you are sitting. It is important that in none of these present exercises should you visualize people, especially people you know. Once you have established strong visualization of the new room, try developing imaginary touch. Try to feel the texture of the curtains, the surface of the table or whatever. Do this until the sensation comes through strongly. Your next step is again very similar. This time choose a room in the home of a friend. It should be a room quite well known to you from visits, but it will obviously be less familiar than the rooms in your own home. Treat this room the same way as the others, including the touch aspect. With regular practice, your visualizations will have become not only more vivid but easier. You are now ready to tackle something more complicated. Prepare for your next exercise by buying a book of short stories by some author you find particularly entertaining. Read one prior to your visualization period. Then try to see the story as it happened. Follow the characters through the various scenes in the story. Build up their looks and mannerisms in as much detail as you can manage. Try to hear the dialogue with the inner ear. A pathway to the doors. Once proficiency is achieved, your next exercise is to make up a story of your own. Don't worry too much about plot, that's something best left to the professionals. But do try to build up a variety of characters and scenes. The characters should be imaginary, not people you know. It is also important that you should spend a little time working out your story beforehand. Unless you do so, the exercise may well tail off into an idle day, dream. A slight, but real, danger may manifest about this stage. Some individuals develop their powers of visualization to a very high degree. Their pictures take on a distinct reality tone without any question of trance arising. It is obviously vital that no confusion should ever arise between the inner and outer levels. To guard against this, most occultists make use of a ritual gesture, designed to clearly mark the beginning and ending of each visualization session. Those of you with a religious turn of mind may wish to use the sign of the cross. For others, simple gestures as if opening and closing a curtain will be effective. The important thing is to make your gesture physically and to use it every time. Your training, if faithfully carried out, will by this stage leave you soundly equipped to make use of the doorways. You should be able to make routine inspections of the astral plane and have even gone some way towards laying a foundation for more complex operations such as realistic path working. But it may be that you will want to go further. If so, the following exercise, although extremely difficult to master, will pay dividends in the future. For it, you return to geometrical figures. But this time in three dimensions. Start with a simple cube. Visualize it strongly and imagine yourself touching it. Feel the texture of its surface. Now try to imagine how it looks from various angles. Do not confine yourself simply to walking round it, as you did with your imaginary rooms. Try to find novel viewpoints. You may, for instance, try seeing it from below, or from above and a little to the right. Change your perspective often, so that in the end you can see the cube from all angles as easily as if you were looking at a physical solid. This is not easy, and the next stage is more difficult still. You must try to visualize the whole cube at once. Try to see all six sides simultaneously. Surround the entire solid with your astral vision, so that while you view it from all angles it suffers no distortion. Only practice will help you manage this. Properly done, it is not so much a talent as a knack. In many ways it is like learning to ride a bicycle or swing a golf club. One moment it seems impossible. The next you are doing it. The exercise is one that should not be carried to excess. Some people never master it. Those who do are advised to congratulate themselves, then stop. If praised too long, the inherent paradox in the experience can have a very disturbing effect on the mind. Chapter 3: The Ultimate Protection. You can certainly find something of value in the subject. But before you reach it, you will come across a lot of junk. Facing me as I write are a score of books full of useless spells and conjurations. They promise the world and deliver nothing. There is a hint of mania about them. The medieval grimoires especially seem to have been composed exclusively by psychopaths. The trouble with this is a lot of people miss the diamond for the rubbish. Or, worse still, confuse the two. Underscore, MG is an inner science, an ancient system of psychology. Viewed in this light, results follow. There is some evidence suggesting a parallelism between psychic processes and physical events. So a possibility exists that magic can influence the physical world. But the devil won't appear to build cathedrals. No spell will produce a rain of gold. These are things of fairy tales, not magic. I am making this point because your ideas about magic have 1LM9ST certainly been conditioned by fairy tales. You grow up to decide, regretfully, that magic will not work. When an occultist claims magical results are possible, you require that he proves it within your fairy tale framework. But if proof is forthcoming, you can be sure you clever conjuring not magic. For centuries, the real magical techniques have our watching been closely guarded secrets. The reason for this is the same reason that a warning has been printed at the beginning of this book. The techniques are dangerous. By and large, the secrets were well kept. But no system of security is completely watertight. Over the years, some things leaked out, or were discovered independently. Hypnosis is one example. The psychological application of alchemy is another. These subjects, along with others such as telepathy, precognition and clairvoyance, are intelligently studied outside occult fraternities. Others, however, are known only from partial leakage. The result is that they have been embodied in the world's vast store of superstition. When did you last walk under a ladder without feeling uncomfortable? That one dates back to ancient Egypt. Circumstances exist where it is unwise to break a triangle. You know the ladder forms a triangle with a wall and ground. You do not know why it should be unlucky to break the triangle, but you tend to avoid it just the same. Should you take your courage in your hands and walk under the ladder, nothing much will happen. Even a paint pot falling on your head is unlikely. You might reasonably conclude that the superstition about walking under ladders is nonsense. And you would be right. But should you also conclude the ancient Egyptian priests were fools, you would be wrong. Because in certain occult ceremonies, the breaking of a triangle can lead to disaster. All this may seem as a far cry from psychological experiments with the astral doorways, but it is not. For the only people who have so far studied this field in any depth are the occultists. And the only techniques of protection for the astral voyager are occult techniques. Let us now examine one of them. It was developed, so far as I know, by the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn in the last century. It is called the Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram. To top page 21. Stand facing east. Visualize a sphere of white light immediately above the crown of your head. Reach up with your right hand to touch this sphere. Bring your right hand down to touch your forehead, at the same time visualizing a shaft of light being drawn down into your body. Say, "Ate." Bring your hand down to touch your breast, visualizing the shaft of light extending through your body to your feet. Say, "Malkuth." Touch your right shoulder, at which you visualize another sphere of power. Say, "Vijebara." Bring your hand across to touch your left shoulder, visualizing a second shaft of light passing through your body. Say, "Vijejula." Clasp your hands on your breast, strongly visualizing the cross of light in your body. Say, "La Olahim." Amen. This completes the first stage of the ritual, known as the Kabbalistic cross. The words used are Hebrew. You will probably recognize them in translation: "To thee the kingdom, the power and the glory, forever. Amen." Now, stretching out your right hand, first and second fingers extended. Draw a pentagram in the air before you as shown in figure 3. Draw the figure large, starting with your hand in the region of your left hip and sweeping smoothly upwards to the natural top limit. Visualize the lines of the figure as white fire. When the figure is complete, draw back your hand and stab it through the middle with your outstretched fingers saying, Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey. With your arm outstretched, walk to the south, tracing a line of fire as you go. Draw a second pentagram, stab it and say, Ah, Do, Nai. Walk to the west and repeat, saying A, He, Ye. Walk to the north and repeat, saying, Ah, G, La. Return to the east, closing the imaginary circle of fire in the center of the first pentagram. Extend your arms to form a cross. Visualize the Archangel Raphael in front of you. See him in yellow robes and imagine air currents flowing from him towards you. Say, before me, Raphael. Visualize the Archangel Gabriel behind you in the west. His robes are blue and he stands against a background of the sea. Say, behind me, Gabriel. Visualize the Archangel Michael in the south. His robes are red and he stands against a fiery, volcanic landscape. Say, comma on my right hand, Michael. Visualize the Archangel Uriel in the north. He wears dark robes, olive, russet, citrine and black, and stands against a background of fertile earth. Say, on my left hand, Uriel. Holding all your visualizations strongly, say, about me flame the pentagrams. Behind me shines the six, red star. Repeat the Kabbalistic cross. This completes the ritual which underscore is widely underscore used even today as an opening ceremony in many occult lodges. If you were to watch it being performed, you would notice no objective results, unless you are particularly sensitive to atmosphere. But objective results are not the aim. The pentagram ritual is an astral operation and as such works very well. I mentioned earlier that on the astral, symbols take on a life and importance of their own. This short ritual is packed with symbols. First comes the symbol of light. Even a cursory glance at mystical literature shows the idea of light recurs time and again. It is used to symbolize the highest spiritual experience. Through such it has great importance to the mind. The cross is another potent symbol. Since it is pre-Christian in origin, it has universal application. As archangels, Raphael, Gabriel, Michael and Uriel have significance to anyone with a Christian or a Jewish background. As elemental kings and rulers of the cardinal points, their appeal too becomes universal. The pentagram, drawn with a single point upwards, denotes the dominion of spirit over the four elements. The six, red star, the Star of David, shows spiritual consciousness intermingled with individual personality. Academic analysis of the symbols is unimportant. Experience will show their automatic appeal to your mind. They stand for psychic realities and their use on the futural plane will call up the realities behind them. It may be as well now to refer back to the diagrams in Chapter 1. The astral plane is a plastic medium shaped by underlying forces in the psyche. If during an astral trip you come across an unpleasant apparition, remember that its form is pure imagination, but the force behind it is real enough on a mental level. If you decide to make use of the symbols, either to test your visions or protect yourself from them, you are simply building an astral form for positive psychic forces to use. It is the underlying forces and not the form which will protect you. And this leads me to a very important point. The symbols are useful in an emergency. But it would obviously be better to make sure emergencies do not arise. This is your ultimate protection. And you can only achieve it by self-knowledge. I cannot over-stress this point. If you run into something nasty on the astral, it is because something nasty already exists in your mind. The astral plane does nothing more than give it form. It is this fact that underlies all magical instruction about purity of motive, emotional control and self-awareness. The yogi who has achieved perfect self-control can venture freely on the astral. The saint, who has spent years purifying his soul, will meet no dangers there. Fortunately, few of us carry the seeds of serious psychosis. But if they are there, in your mind, They will flower during astral experiments. Consequently, it is best to give yourself a really searching self-examination before experiments are attempted. Observe yourself closely, ruthlessly. Examine your fears and aversions, your emotions and your moods. Discover the reasons for them. And learn to control them. This may be the most difficult job you will ever attempt. It will certainly be the most worthwhile. There are various ways of going about this. You could, and the suggestion is made quite seriously, undergo full psychoanalysis, preferably with a Jungian psychiatrist. The drawback here is time and cost, but at least you can be sure of the results. If this course is completely out of the question, another possibility is to make up magic mirrors as suggested by Franz Baden. These are mirrors in the figurative sense, mirrors of your soul. Take a notebook and divide each page into two columns. Head one of these with the words, black mirror, and the other with white mirror. Each day make at least one entry under each heading. Under black should go all those negative characteristics you notice in yourself. Meanness, for instance. Or cowardice. Or envy. Under white should go the positive characteristics, loyalty, courage, intelligence, etc. The testing time will come when you are convinced both columns are full. That is the time to keep working with your mirrors. Because that is the time your unconscious strengths and weaknesses will begin to come out. Another useful approach is dream analysis. The problem here is how to catch your dream. Again, notebook and pencil are the important tools. Leave them at your bedside and note your dreams immediately after waking. There is, unfortunately, no substitute for immediate action. The notes should be the very first thing you do after waking. They must be made before jetting out of bed, even before rubbing the sleep from your eyes or stretching your body. This calls for considerable will power, but I know of no other way. Dreams evaporate within seconds. Scientists are convinced we have numerous dreams every night. We remember perhaps one or two a week. Should you still find difficulty in remembering your dreams even with this rigorous routine, try visualizing the rising sun the moment you wake up. This is an odd psychological trick that often helps recall. Having caught your dreams, don't waste time with pseudo-occult books at interpretation. Your dream is your own. Only you can see the meaning in it. Even an experienced psychologist can only point the way towards this. Examine the dream situations and ask yourself what they mean to you. Give your intuition full play. And face up to the results. Down p. 25, Chapter 4, The Elemental Doorways. During the early months of 1969, I conducted a series of experiments with the elemental doorways to the astral plane. The situation leading up to these experiments was curious. My wife and I are tenants of a wing to a Georgian mansion in Ireland. The immediate estate extends for several hundred acres. On this estate are two monuments of considerable historical interest. The first is the ruin of a medieval church, set in a little wood close to the main house. Records show this church, which is of Norman design, was founded in 1210. A small graveyard attached remained in use up to the end of the 19th century. The second, about a mile walk from the house and located on the highest ground in the estate, is a prehistoric monolith surrounded by a well-preserved rift. Experts have dated the monument as Bronze Age. The earthwork of the ring fort is circular to a tolerance of a foot or so, while the granite monolith, which stands more than 20 feet high and weighs an estimated 12 tons, is set in the exact mathematical center. There are two breaks in the earthwork, roughly due east and west. Beside the western gap is a hawthorn tree, the traditional fairy thorn of Ireland. Inside this enclosure, the ground slopes upwards towards the center, rather like an inverted saucer. Immediately beneath the standing stone is a cist grave 8 feet long and just under 4 feet deep. Archaeological excavations were carried out on the site in 1912. These unearthed evidence of human remains in the grave and a charcoal layer extending about 50 feet in radius from the central stone. There was no evidence that the ring fort had ever been used, even temporarily, as a residence. Despite the ring fort, There is little likelihood that the site had any military significance either. It may originally have been intended as an elaborate monument to some tribal chieftain. But the bones found in the grave seem like those of a woman, so the most likely explanation is that it was put to religious use. As often happens with pre-Christian sites, that became a focus for local superstition. You might, for instance, walk 3 times around the stone to have a wish granted. Or, if you happened to be a single female, you could pin some offering to the fairy thorn to secure a husband. Within living memory, a woman, inevitably reputed to have been a witch, was killed by the little people at the root. She went there to gather firewood and broke some branches from the thorn. The tree reacted murderously, for she was found dead on the spot next morning. Today most of the old superstitions have died too, but neither archaeology nor folklore can account for the distinctive atmosphere that remains. My wife, who is mediumistic, cannot spend more than 5 minutes inside the earthwork ring. She becomes nervous and uncomfortable. Eventually she has to leave. Both cattle and sheep, which often graze in the surrounding fields, tend to avoid the site, although not completely. The common explanation is bitter grass. But bitter grass does not explain the discomfort cats appear to feel in the area. The aura of Terry Place is not consistent. At times there is no atmosphere at all. My own observations indicate a build-up of force around the old solar festivals, the equinoxes and the solstices. None of this is to suggest that exudes evil. Although powerful at its peak, the force seems elemental. Such forces exist on many ancient sites. They may not be objective, but they are real. Sensitive people react to them. During Christmas week of 1968, my wife and I entertained friends from Northern Ireland. One evening the discussion turned to the occult. Someone suggested a group journey to the astral and I agreed. The technique used was that of a cribalistic path working. This is something I will deal with later since it has no relevance at present. The trip went smoothly and immediately afterwards, two of the party took a moonlight stroll to the root. Early in the new year, a young Dutch couple, Nick and Bee Van Vliet, visited the estate. Since trips to its monuments are almost compulsory, we found ourselves at the root. The Van Vliet's interest was not entirely historical. Like many of their fellow countrymen, they had a mystical turn of mind. Both were very much aware of the eightness of the root, which was quite potent at that time. I was bombarded with questions about the site. Partly in self-defense I suggested psychometry. Psychometry is a spiritualist curiosity. It involves picking up vibrations from objects. By this means, past associations with a seven object can be described by a sensitive Nick Van Vliet offered to try psychometry on the granite monolith. He climbed the metal protective fence and stood embracing the huge stone with his forehead pressed against it. Very shortly he began to describe the mental pictures which arose. I am not much impressed by theories involving mysterious vibrations. But I know from experience that psychometry can work, sometimes with quite spectacular success. The degree of success in this case was spectacular, although not in the way we expected. Instead of piecing up prehistoric memories, Nick Van Vliet started to describe visions of countryside. For a moment I could not think of why the scenes were so hauntingly familiar. Then I realized he was describing details of the astral journey my guests and I had undertaken at Christmas. It was an eerie situation. And it became more so. Bee Van Vliet, standing beside me outside the metal fence, whispered further details of the Lautney into my ear. She was, she felt, picking them up telepathically from her husband. Van Vliet was a skilled professional visualizer. His wife, apart from her telepathic sensitivity, also showed considerable natural talent in this direction. In view of the startling experience at the root, I asked them to cooperate in a series of experiments. They agreed and the first experiment took place soon after. The initial experience was a catastrophe. We adopted the cribalistic method. Both the Van Vliets reacted by being violently and physically ill. Two further attempts using the same technique produced similar unfortunate results. To their credit, neither allowed this unhappy introduction to dampen their enthusiasm. A little later in the evening, They were quite prepared to attempt the elemental doorways. There are 5 basic elemental doorways to the astral plane. They were developed, or discovered, in the Orient and introduced to the West, along with a complementary collection of doctrines, by the Golden Dawn. They are usually referred to in occult filature as the Tiwas or the Tatwa symbols. In the original Hindu terminology, these symbols are named Akasa, Vayu, Tejas, Apas and Prithivi. Each one is associated with an alchemical element and equate, in the order given, to ether or spirit, air, fire, water and earth. I propose to stick to the Western terms as being easier to remember. If you will now refer to figure 4, the symbols are given in outline. Your first step towards using the doorways is to make a set of cards incorporating these symbols. A convenient size is 3 to 4 inches square and whiteboard should be used. Draw one symbol on each card, leaving the back blank. When this is done, the symbols should be colored as follows: ether, black or indigo; air, blue; fire, red; water, silver; earth, yellow. Down page 29 in online book on vk.com. It is important that the colors are strong and brilliant, so water colors are virtually useless for the job. Poster paints are a little better, but not much. The most successful cards are done in oils, or made by cutting colored papers to shape and sticking them down. If available, a transparent film covering the card heightens the effect and protects the surface. In choosing the correct shades, strength and brilliancy are again the guidelines. A glaring pillar box red will be effective in the fire triangle. A strong sky blue works well in the air disc. Black and silver should present no difficulties. For the earth square, a bright light yellow should be chosen in preference to the mustard hues. Making the symbol cards is an easy enough job and using them is almost as simple, although a certain knack is involved here. Seat yourself comfortably and relax as you did for your visualization exercises. The first part of the operation requires a strong light. But since this can sometimes interfere with the subsequent process, it is as well to have the light set up beside your chair so that it can be switched off easily. Now choose your symbol. The Hindu tradition accepts Twaha Tatwik tides in the astral light. The sequence begins at dawn with ether and changes every 2 hours in the order given. But calculations can be abandoned in favor of a trial and error system. It will soon be found that one symbol works more efficiently than the others. Stare fixedly at the symbol for between 30 seconds and a minute. The time varies from person to person. A good indication that you have stared long enough is a slight halo effect which tends to appear around the symbol. Once this halo comes up, turn the card over and stare at the blank surface of the back. In a few seconds, an optical reflex produces an illusion of the symbol shape in its complementary color. If, for instance, you are using the fire triangle, you will see a green triangle on the back. The exact shade depends on the original RCD and, to some extent, on the lighting of the room. There will, however, be a certain degree of luminosity. Top page 32 in book, original, Astral Doorways. Immediately you see the reflex symbol, close your eyes and visualize it in the complementary color. Darkness often helps at this stage so you can switch out the light. Now mentally enlarge the picture until it is several feet high and visualize it as a doorway directly in front of you. Experience shows that even trained visualizers sometimes have difficulty with this part, so a useful alternative is to picture yourself shrinking instead. The important thing is to regularize your dimensions with relation to the symbol. Once you do this, you have reached the tricky part. You must now consider the symbol as a doorway and imagine yourself passing through it. This is not a question of watching a mental picture of yourself. Instead, you should try to move through as you would a physical door. How difficult this is depends on the individual. Some people find they can pass through with the greatest of ease. Often they do not quite know how they managed it. Others try time and again before succeeding. Golden Dawn members were taught to make the Zalata sign at this point to help projection through the doorway. This does sometimes help. It is identical, so far as I can see, to the straight, armed Nazi salute. If you want to make use of it, stand up and perform the action physically. Another trick taught to Golden Dawn members was to meditate on the given element before making use of a symbol.